The Sky News Centre at 6. The business secretary, Sajid Javid's been challenged by steelworkers in Port Talbot, where thousands of jobs are at risk. Staff at Tata, which is selling all its UK assets, say the government's failed to tackle high costs within the industry and prevent cheap steel imports flooding the market. After hold meetings in Port Talbot, Mr. Javid faced tough questions from a crowd of anxious staff at the plant.
We will do everything we can to help continue steelmaking here in Port Talbot.
Have we got an industry?
I said the industry is absolutely vital to the future of UK industrial sector.
That's wrong.
A delivery driver has been found guilty of preparing to carry out a terror attack on US troops based in the UK. Police believe 25-year-old Junaid Khan from Luton planned to stage a car crash and attack American military personnel with a knife. Commander Dean Hayden from the Metropolitan Police says he'd also exchanged online messages with an IS fighter.
Certainly when I look at his plot and his attack plan, but also his intention to travel out to Syria and fight alongside Daesh, you know, he posed a real risk to public safety.
Junaid will be sentenced at Kingston Crown Court next month. An inmate's been murdered at a jail in Surrey. Officials say 25-year-old Madala Washington died at HMP Coldingley in Woking, a Category C prison which holds 500 people. A taxi driver's appeared in court via video link charged with the murder of Becky Godden Edwards, who went missing in Bristol in 2002. Christopher Halliwell, who's 52 and from Swindon, spoke only to confirm his name. A woman from County Tyrone who was jailed for trying to smuggle cocaine out of Peru has been freed early. Michaela McCollum has been released on parole after serving around a third of her sentence. And in sport, Britain's world champion Lewis Hamilton has finished behind Mercedes teammate Nico Rosberg for the second practice session in a row ahead of the Bahrain F1 Grand Prix. Jenson Button was in third place. That's the latest. I'm Victoria Lawrence.
Pious Christians sometimes make me very angry. They don't even know Christianity. They don't know the man they're following. He was a revolutionary. He was a dangerous man. And by God, so am I. And so should you be. This country was founded by dangerous men. The moment the people in this country cease to be dangerous men, it's going to be the day we cease to have a country.
Back to BCFM's Politics Show with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Brussels under attack, but yet again, the story presented by the Belgian authorities and known ISIS propaganda websites is full of holes. Which go unchallenged by the mainstream press. Plus, we look forward to Thursday the 23rd of June and the EU referendum, but in the context of fraud last year's general election. We heard from journalist Simon Hines on this show about suspicious Tory swings in all the marginal constituencies, about disappearing ballot papers, about postal vote fraud, which is now under investigation by former Tory minister Eric Pickles. The latest facts in an investigation conducted by Channel 4 News' Michael Crick relate to the Conservative Party breaking electoral law by overspending, then presenting false accounts to Thornbury and Yate and a dozen or so marginal seats. To discuss the prospects of a free and fair EU referendum vote, I'm joined by our Whitney correspondent Dave Barmby. But first, the Brussels attacks. Before we try and find out who really did it, we go through the dozens or so holes in the official Brussels bombing story. The mainstream media don't dare to ask and explain why what we're being told doesn't add up. Martin, what's your first thoughts about last week's attack in Brussels?
Well, first thing, of course, is to put it in context. We know from studies of history that NATO intelligence services, who are based in Brussels, have a track record of basically faking terrorist attacks. I mean, carrying terrorist attacks out, but blaming others for what they have themselves done. So you could compare, for example, the Brabant massacres in the 1980s, where supermarkets in Belgium were attacked by attackers wearing Halloween masks who shot people at random. And police investigations in Belgium is subsequently established beyond any reasonable doubt that this was actually being carried out by NATO intelligence services as part of a strategy of tension. And Belgium has actually suffered quite a lot from this kind of thing over the years. So the first thing to do is to put it in a context. We know that this kind of thing has happened in the past. Is it what's happening today?
Also, of course, as part of those Operation Gladio attacks, there was the rather nasty bombing at the Oktoberfest in 1980 in Germany. In fact, that was Germany's last major terrorist incident, was actually carried out by, it seems now, by NATO. In fact, the German documentary programme that came out last year re-looked at that and said that there was actually a massive police cover-up, and it looked as if that the secret state in Germany was one of the main instigators behind the Oktoberfest bomb, which killed something like 20 people, I believe, in 1980.
Yes, well, I mean, after the Paris attacks, Erdogan, who's the president of Turkey, turned up to the sort of, you know, solidarity fest afterwards. But he raised questions about whether the Israeli intelligence services had been involved in the attacks in Paris. Now, that's not the sort of thing you hear on Radio 4, but it was in fact what he said, and he might even have been right about that. But of course, the other things that are quite interesting is that these attackers, who have been, if they are the attackers, who carried out this Brussels attack, had been inside Syria, cooperating with MIT, which is the Turkish intelligence services, in order to try and overthrow Assad. And the YPG, which is the Kurdish militias inside northern Syria, have captured a Turkish intelligence officer inside Syria, and they've interrogated him. And what he's been saying is that, yes, indeed, they were working for MIT, these terrorists, and that they were being infiltrated into Brussels, into Belgium, to attack these targets. But, of course, that will be NATO operations. Don't forget, MIT is an integral part of NATO's intelligence structure, which is headed up by CIA MI6.
Interesting, isn't it, that Erdogan, on the Friday before the Brussels attack, actually did you say that there could be an attack in Brussels?
Well, indeed. And he also, he then said, we sent these terrorists towards you, and we even warned you that they were terrorists, and you did nothing. Well, you know, that's a bit of a giveaway, isn't it? We sent these people on to you and warned you they were terrorists, but you did nothing. What are you doing sending terrorists to Belgium? And of course, they were inside Syria. They were then supposedly picked up by the Turkish police and then deported. And both of them had track records as bank robbers and petty thieves. Are these the kind of people who would kill themselves for ideology? Well, that's another question.
Well, that's interesting you talk about suicide bombers there, because the source of that news is the AMAQ news agency, AMAQ news agency. They were the people who immediately said that there were several ISIS fighters that detonated explosive belts at the airport and the train station. The investigators then, we were told, reportedly also found pretty much immediately chemical products and an Islamic State flag. But this AMAQ news agency, Martin, these are the people that release information to the mainstream press about ISIS. And they also release that information through something called SITE, which is run by Rita Katz in the United States. We've been talking about them before.
Yeah, well, SITE is supposedly, the SITE stands for Searching the Internet for Terrorist Entities. And it is an organisation based in Langley, Virginia, just down the road from the CIA. And for some reason, it's headed up by Rita Katz, who's a former Israeli intelligence agent, and they seem to get all of ISIS's videos first. ISIS seem to use them as their favoured place to put out their extreme videos. If people can't start to smell what's wrong with all of this by now, they need to start.
But then we quickly heard that apparently they weren't suicide bombers, or at least one of them wasn't. They were actually just pushing their bombs on airport trolleys. Let's just make it clear to start with that the bomb took place just before the check-in, so it wasn't in the departure lounge of the airport where the gates are. It was really not even properly subject to security. But this is the first part of the story that changed immediately. We were told, first of all, they had suicide belts on. Then we were told, no, actually, they were pushing their bombs on their trolley, and they just decided that they were going to die when that bomb exploded. Now, this is a new kind of suicide bomber that we're coming across.
Well, more likely is that they were patsies and the bombs were, you know, they don't even know they're carrying the bombs necessarily. These questions all have to be raised. And, of course, the security at Brussels Airport is run by ICTS, which is an Israeli-linked security company who happened to be in charge of Schiphol Airport.
Hang on, because just to be fair, you can't blame ICTS. Anybody can walk into an airport at the to the check-in area.
I think it's an extraordinary coincidence that the airports where these incidents happen all happen to have ICTS. Most people don't realise that the privatisation of security at international airports...
Security wasn't even involved in this case. Anybody can go into a car park and go up to a check-in desk. There is no security.
No, but I still think it's of some significance. Because ICTS were in charge of security at Schiphol when the so-called underpants bomber got on the plane, and according to eyewitnesses, a senior solicitor who was on a lawyer who was on the plane,
Kurt Haskell,
he was taken through without a passport, with only a one-way ticket, and with no shoes on, and all the rest of it. He was taken straight through without even being checked. We've got to get people to understand, in Turkey itself, for example, the so-called ISIS attacks on the Kurdish rally, the two Kurdish rallies, and the other attack that may or may not be ISIS that took place in Ankara not long ago. Everybody in Turkey knows that their own intelligence services are often implicated in these attacks. That's what restarted the war between the PKK and the Turkish government, is they immediately presumed, and rightly, in my view, that the ISIS attack on their rally, which killed 30 of their young militants, was in fact carried out by MIT agents, by the Turkish army.
Yes, and of course they've closed the Zaman newspaper down, which was
reporting that two things. It reported that the Turkish involvement in the chemical weapons attack at Ghouta, and they also reported that the Turkish police had stopped a convoy of weaponry going into Turkey, into Syria, and the people who were driving the trucks were all MIT operatives.
Well,
Turkish intelligence agents.
You mentioned the attack in Ankara on Saturday the 12th of March. That killed 37 people, but I think it's in context. Let's look, because we've had a lot of attacks, haven't we, over the last few weeks. Then on Sunday the 13th of March in Ivory Coast, there were 16 people killed by gunmen at some kind of resort there. Tuesday the 15th of March, Mastaba Market in Yemen, 120 people were killed, actually civilians at a market, by a Saudi airstrike, 120 killed in Yemen. Tuesday the 22nd of March was the Brussels attacks, where we now know 31, although CNN and others still seem to be saying 35. I don't know quite why. But then on Good Friday there was an attack in Baghdad, Iraq. 41 people were killed, but there were attacks pretty much weekly in Iraq, actually two or three bomb attacks in Turkey every week. And then on Sunday the 27th in Lahore, Pakistan, 65 people were killed. So this does seem to be, it's almost like another day, another suicide bomber or another bomb attack. And it's very little time to actually analyse, which is why it's interesting and I think important to take a step back from this and do a bit of analysis and contextualise what happened in Brussels. And of course, Brussels being the headquarters of NATO and the European Union.
Indeed. So you've got to ask yourself, well, who benefits from these attacks?
Is it fair to say it's the EU's 9/11?
I think we're... 9/11 has got many holes in the official story as well. What we're seeing, the pattern is becoming clearer, because in Turkey it's absolutely clear that MIT, the Turkish intelligence services, are an integral part of NATO. They work with MI6, they work with SAS, they work with CIA.
So the reason you're joining Turkey with this is you're saying, although we're not in a political alliance with Turkey, we're very much in a military alliance.
Well, indeed, when we are in a political alliance with them as well. I mean, the PKK is still basically regarded as a terrorist organisation by the British government, even though many would argue that they are freedom fighters, just like in Syria or in Libya.
Anyway, one of the most important bits of information to come out, at least in my view, is the presence of at least one soldier. Well, you don't really get generally one soldier on their own in the airport at the time of the bomb attacks. Actually, behind the scenes, it seems to be being described here by airport worker Tom Donko. And here's an extract from BBC 5 Live on the day with his testimony of what he saw. He's an airport worker, Tom Donko.
So he ran away from the airport as fast as he can, and everybody else that was in the terminal followed immediately after.
Tom Donker's an airport worker. He told the BBC he'd actually just started his shift when the first explosion came.
We were going to our desks to the gate, and we looked to our left side, and it looked like 50 meters of us was a big explosion. First, we thought it was a billboard falling down or something. And my colleague was looking and was wondering what is it. And I said, "Run!" We ran away. We were running very quickly. My colleague jumped into the carousel behind the check-in desk. I lost him because I didn't know where he was. I ran straight on, and it was like 20 centimeters of me. It was a big explosion, a second one, a big explosion. I thought I was hurt, I was hit. And then there were two people who were working at the on the airport. They told me to come inside. They locked the door, and behind a little gap, I saw a soldier pulling away a body. I hope he was not dead, and he was just hit.
Tom Donker, an airport worker. The travel editor of The Independent, Simon Calder, says...
Well, that's Tom Donker there, Martin. Quite interesting to hear that there's at least one soldier there on the scene ready to deal with dead and injured.
Indeed, and of course we're still getting more information as time goes on. As you pointed out,
we get less. It seems to close down, and it's at these initial moments, like literally on the day that you're here, that actually there was a soldier there. That's not normal for a soldier to be at the scene of a bomb attack like that. Did they have a warning? It's got to be, or was there an exercise or something?
Indeed, but as Haaretz pointed out, the Israeli newspaper, that Belgian intelligence had precise warning that the airport was targeted for the bombing. Also, of course, on the day, the Belgian media immediately issued what they claimed to be CCTV footage of the bombings, which was then exposed by The Independent as being CCTV footage from a bombing in Moscow and a bombing in Minsk, which had taken place some time previously. Now, they'd obviously changed the time signatures and the date stamps and everything on these videos, so it wasn't an accident, and it was kind of presented in The Independent as the social media were already circulating these incorrect videos. It wasn't social media which was the source of it. It was Belgian mainstream media, who presumably, had been tipped off to do their bit of creating the right impression around the attack. Just like the attack in Bologna in 1980, which killed 86 people. People forget about these things, but that was shown by police investigation in Italy to be SISMI, i.e. NATO Intelligence Services.
Okay.
So it may or may not be NATO Intelligence Services, but the balance of probability is that they are behind this.
Okay, the police also questioned the Brussels bombers just a week before the airport and subway attacks. We hear Khalid and Brahim El Bakrawi were again arrested just a few days before the 22nd of March 2016 attack, according to the Centre for Security Policy. So it seems like many of these terrorist attacks, you've got people who are actually right at the top of the terror watch list who then manage to get themselves bombs and blow
them
up.
Well, like the Kouachi brothers who supposedly carried out the Paris attacks, who had been on the watch list for ages, carried out the attacks and then conveniently left their passports to implicate themselves so that they could then be rounded up and shot and blamed for what had happened. There's going to be some interesting fallout from this, because some of the so-called terrorists have survived and will have to be put on trial, and it may be that we'll find something out from that. But if we look at what happened with the Boston bombing trials of Tsarnaev brothers and so on, trials can be fixed as well. And we've got a track record of NATO intelligence services, particularly the Turks, but not only the Turks, in the Ergonikon networks in Turkey were exposed, and senior generals were sent to prison. It was absolutely clear what they were doing. They were bombing, shooting, killing, pretending to be Islamists, but in actual fact it was the Turkish military. And I would suggest that the hands of the Turkish military, fingerprints of the Turkish military, are quite likely to be found on this attack if you look closely enough.
In October 2014, a jihadi training camp was discovered in Belgium, just a couple of hours by car from Brussels, almost like under the noses of NATO, jihadist training in the woods, in the Ardennes forest.
Yes, well, that sounds very similar to the Gladio training camps that used to exist back in the 70s and the 80s, where right-wing militants were being trained to bomb, shoot, kill, attack people in supermarkets. And, of course, it was all... What you answer, well, why do they do this? In the 1980s, what it was about, you had a socialist government in Belgium which did not want US cruise missiles, and were going to vote to have US cruise missiles not to be sighted on Belgian soil. But very embarrassing, because in the headquarters of NATO is at Shape in Brussels. So suddenly all of these mad attacks start happening, and then the politicians get the message. You stay in line, or we're going to make trouble for you.
We're also told, aren't we, of course, that this is an ISIS attack, but Michael Flynn from the Defence Intelligence Agency has said that the creation of ISIS was a willful decision of the White House.
Well, Michael Flynn's a very interesting character, because he was actually in charge of US military in the Middle East, and he's been pushed out now, and one of the things he's done is he's leaked the NSA report, which said that we know what ISIS is about. They're going to take over a large chunk of Syria. In actual fact, we're quite positive about that, because that will help to overthrow Assad. So this was a confidential report that he leaked. And the other thing about Flynn is that he then, having resigned from the US military, went to, according to Seymour Hersh in the London Review of Books, who's a very senior journalist in the US, the US Army were passing intelligence to the Syrian Army and to the Russians to help them in Syria to eliminate CIA-supported groups which they were unhappy with. And then Flynn, in fact, appeared in Moscow at the Russia Today's anniversary dinner meeting with Vladimir Putin, and he's now advising Donald Trump on his foreign policy. So I suggest that there are splits developing between the military in the US and the CIA and the other spooks who are basically manipulators.
The mad thing here is that even if it is ISIS, it looks as if the Western intelligence services, NATO intelligence, people like that, are all over ISIS. They know exactly where they are all the time.
Well, this is why Zaman was closed down in Turkey, because they exposed the intimate linkage between the Turkish government and military and ISIS. ISIS is, as far as many people in Syria are concerned, as far as the Iranians are concerned, as far as the Russian general staff are concerned, essentially a NATO Saudi front with the Turks very hands on, and don't forget that the Turks now are in a bit of a dilemma, because what's happened in Syria means that they can't really overthrow Assad, but that puts Erdogan in a very difficult position, puts the Saudis in a very difficult position. So it's in their interests to have terrorist attacks in Western Europe, because they hope that it may provoke a further intervention in Syria to remove Assad. That's where we've got to, and I think that all of these things are likely.
Also, on Sunday, we saw, I think, one of the most strong indications that something funny is going on in Brussels was that the police allowed a fascist march to march right into a march which they said that the peace campaigners shouldn't march, and so there was a vigil there instead. But then the Belgian police didn't... I mean, this is... It's got to be deliberate. They didn't stop the fascists marching. The fascists got together a few blocks away and then just marched without any challenge from the police right into the middle of the peace vigil.
Well, I mean, we've got to work out who's on what side here. Well, one would hope that the police force would be independent of the intelligence services, but you can't rely on that. In Italy, Imposimato is head of the Italian Supreme Court.
Isn't that what the police are for, to stop that sort of thing happening? Also, of course, we know the police do infiltrate both fascist groups and other groups.
Well, indeed.
They know what they're doing.
Yeah, but the problem is how independent are the police
force? It would have been simple for the police to stop that happening.
Yes, and it may be that they're implicated in this stuff. You can't presume that the police are not being manipulated by the intelligence services. It would be nice to think that they weren't, but you can't presume that they're not. I think that these terrorist attacks are part of a strategy to create a police state. That's what they're about. The evidence piled up over many years, and it's got very, very poignant now with what's going on in Turkey and Syria. It's been clearly exposed by the media in Turkey, the linkages between the government and the military and ISIS and Al-Qaeda, Syria, Al-Nusra Front and so on. All of these things are coming, you know, it's futile to deny them. Everybody knows that that's what's been going on. Now, if that's what's been going on, it could be ISIS attacking Brussels airport on their own. But even, as you rightly point out, ISIS is a front organisation for MIT, the Turkish intelligence services, the CIA, and the Saudi Mukhabarat And, you know, everybody who knows anything knows that that's the case.
I would wonder, though, why we don't get any mainstream media coverage of the critique of this. I mean, I actually found it quite unnerving that, you know, the presence of a soldier at the scene of the bomb attack is not even mentioned, not even talked about, not even questioned. And actually, a lot of the journalists are immediately talking about bomb factories as if they're factual. Actually, they're not. They're alleged by the police to be a bomb factory until they've actually been proved. So there seems to be almost immediately jumping on the bandwagon with what the authorities are saying. I think actually the corporate media plays a big role in all this, doesn't it? Because yeah. It's actually part of the rollback of the state is big media. They're part of it.
Well, the whole point of doing these things, if you are a, let's call them a rogue group within the intelligence services, is to achieve certain political effects. Now, from the Turks' point of view, they've been pushing for a Western intervention in Syria to overthrow Assad for ages and ages, but they've been checkmated by the Russian intervention. So they're prime suspects for setting up some kind of atrocity in Europe, right around the corner from NATO headquarters, so that they can then plead for an intervention in Syria to deal with ISIS, which they themselves have created, and as the Russians have shown, Bilal Erdogan, the son of the president, has been massively profiting from trading oil
with
ISIS.
He's got into trouble over in Italy too, hasn't he?
Well, yes, the Bologna magistrates want to interview him as well. They want to extradite him. And of course, in Turkey itself, everybody knows that top generals were convicted of doing exactly this in the Ergonekon trials some years ago. They were basically bombing, shooting, killing, pretending to be right-wingers, left-wingers, Islamists, and they were the whole point of these strategies of tension is to get the population scared of being attacked by Islamists, by fascists, by lefties in the Red Brigades or whatever it is, and then, of course, you bring in the police state, which is the real agenda behind all of this.
What's the point of it all, then?
Well, the point of it all is the oligarchy, which ultimately controls things, uses terrorism as a mechanism of political control. If we had an outright hierarchical oligarchic society, you know, a Nazi Germany, for example, you don't have to bother with all of this. You just say, this is what we're doing, and if you get in the way, we'll bump you off. But, of course, in semi-democracies, you've got to bamboozle people. So in order to force them to give up their rights and freedoms, you have to scare the pants off with random terrorist attacks.
One of those rights and freedoms is the intelligence sovereignty that was immediately being said. Actually, all of these countries around Europe are now being pressurised to share all their intelligence with each other, saying, well, if you do that, then we will be able to prevent these sorts of attacks in future.
Well, yes, what people have to understand is that there's been a long-running strategy of tension underpinning NATO's actions for 20, 30, 40 years, going right back to the 1940s. And don't forget, as we have sometimes covered on this programme, the Nazis' intelligence structure was integrated into NATO as NATO was set up. So Reinhard Gehlen, who was the head of the Gestapo, becomes the head of the West German intelligence service.
Well, also the SS, foreign SS units were also incorporated into the first meetings of NATO, weren't they?
So, in other words, there's been a long-running... this is a game that they've been playing for a very long time. The 1993 bombings in Paris, of the Paris Metro. Investigations there showed that it wasn't in fact carried out by the GIA, or it was carried out by the GIA, who were an extremist Islamist group, but the GIA was itself a counter-gang created by the Algerian army, with the help of their French counterparts, to discredit Islamism. And this is the kind of way these people think. If you've got, a Muslim insurgency that you're trying to deal with, what you do is you pretend to be Muslim insurgents and you go out and behead people, blow things up, to create mayhem, and blame the others who are supposed to have done it. The Seller Scouts did a similar thing in Rhodesia. They went around pretending to be Zandler, massacring people and so on. And it goes all the way back to the Kenya in the 1950s, and Captain Frank Kitson, then Brigadier Frank Kitson's book, Gangs and Counter-Gangs, about how... it's still the British Army's counterinsurgency manual. How you fight insurgents is, but you create... false insurgents so that they look as if they are the insurgents, and then they go out and do atrocities, and you blame the insurgents for those atrocities. It's a standard tactic. They've been doing it for years. The Italian police have investigated this fairly thoroughly because they've got independent magistrates in Italy, and they did look into all of this fairly. I mean, Imposimato, the head of the Supreme Court, has written a book about it all, which came out in 2012, pointing out that virtually all terrorism in Italy in the 70s and 80s was carried out by the intelligence services. I would suggest that that's still likely to be the case today.
How long until we get some sort of nuclear terrorist attack?
Well,
after the Brussels attacks, the leaders, world leaders, are looking at the threat of nuclear terrorism, we hear. Still reeling from the attacks in Brussels and Paris, world leaders wrestling this week with the chilling prospect of the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, ISIS, or other extremists unleashing a nuclear attack on a major Western city.
Well, If your goal ultimately is to invade Syria so that you can get a government that you want, which will build a pipeline that you want to stop the Russians controlling the European gas market, you have to keep going until you get the result you want. And if the bombing in Brussels isn't enough to get NATO into Syria, then maybe something more extreme will have to be done in order to achieve the goal that you're going for. The problem with all of this is that the people behind it, and I think it's people in the Western intelligence services like MI2 who are behind all of this, and our own MI6, is they're so deeply in now, they're so deeply involved in this kind of bloody carnage that they can't back down. And therefore, of course, the possibility of a nuclear false flag attack is definitely there, and because they have put it on the agenda.
And why is it that the last big attacks, terrorist attacks in Belgium, which were found to be carried out by NATO, haven't even had a single mention anywhere in the mainstream press?
Well, that's the problem, isn't it? Because if we don't know, those who do not learn the lessons of history are doomed to repeat the mistakes of the past. And understanding NATO's role in creating terrorism in Turkey in particular and in Belgium is absolutely essential if you want to understand what may have happened in Brussels the other week.
You can listen again to any shows at bcfmradio.com and leave comments about your favourite programmes. BCFM 93.2, your interactive station, 24 hours a day.
Now we move on to have a look at the Thursday, 23rd of June, and the EU referendum. But in the context of fraud at last year's general election, which we've been looking into in this show over the last 6 or 8 months, we heard from Simon Hines about swings in all the marginal constituencies. So it seems there are very many other problems too with it, but it seems that no holds are barred when it comes to referenda and elections, and when we cast our vote it may be that someone is fixing the result, a bit like the lottery perhaps. Anyway, to discuss the prospects for a free and fair EU referendum, I'm joined now by our Whitney correspondent, I hope you don't mind me calling you that, Dave Barmby. Hi Dave, welcome to
whatever
the
Politics
Show.
Whatever you want to call me, yeah.
Well, really? Anyway, first of all, tell us a little bit about yourself, Dave, because I know that you were involved a bit with the actual selection of David Cameron as your local MP.
Yeah, just before we come to that, I'd like to just butt in on your last discussion.
Oh, about Brussels, yeah.
Just heard the tail end of what you said. You obviously have a very learned and sophisticated view about these bombings which seem to go on and on. Myself, I have a somewhat naive view because I think, like many people in society, we switch off and we just don't want to hear it anymore. It seems to me that there's a cycle of violence where we bomb them. When I say we, I mean the French, the Americans, the British, and perhaps the Italians and others bomb them, and they bomb us in retaliation. So it's a cycle of violence. But there may be false flags in there as well. You've got more knowledge about it than I have. The only other thing I would say, I did take an interest in 9/11, if I might just briefly say that. I've been connected with the architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth. Have you heard of those? And they produced this very good booklet, Beyond Misinformation, and they've conclusively proved, I think, that Building 7 was a demolition job. So if it was a demolition job, then who demolished it and why?
But Dave, you're an electrical engineer, not a structural engineer.
No, I think engineers start off their engineering career with general engineering, and they talk to, I mean, I've worked on multidisciplinary projects which involve mostly satellite earth stations and microwave links, and you get involved in a lot of the structural things, and you have to understand bending moments and that type of stuff. I'm not no expert, but looking at the evidence, I think it's conclusively proven by these architects and engineers at 9/11, the Building 7 was a demolition job. So if that was a demolition job, and it's the first building ever, and we're going off topic, I suppose, it's the first building ever that was demolished by so-called fires. And, of course, that leads on to the Twin Towers.
What happened to them? Yeah, well, anyway, what I'll do is I'll put a link to that, a PDF of that document on Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. But anyway, let's get back to you and about David Cameron, because you have had some contact with him and you helped him get the nomination to stand in.
Well, I've been reluctant over the years to talk about somebody I was quite closely involved with back in 2000 and 2001, helping him to become the PPC for Whitney, because you feel you're telling tales about somebody. But since David Cameron has moved so far away from the position he had in 2000, for instance, he claimed that...
That was when he was first selected, was it?
Yes, he was selected in March the 1st, 2000, to be the PBC for Whitney. I played quite a big part in that, because the Conservative Party management wanted Andrew Mitchell as the candidate at that time. If you remember, Sean Woodward had defected to the Labour Party in December 1999, and that's why we had this selection process. And he said that he was, to use his words, he said, I oppose the single currency and any further transfer of sovereignty from the UK to the EU. I've got that on an email. And later on, with these exchange of emails, he says, but these are my views. No to the single currency, no to further transfer of power from Westminster to Brussels, and yes to renegotiation of areas like Fish, where the EU has been a disaster for the UK.
Well, I mean, he'd probably stand with those same views today, wouldn't he?
Well, he finished up by laying his authority on the line by saying, if that's being a Europhile, then I'm a banana. This was in February 2000. Now he goes on the air with Andrew Marr's show and says sovereignty doesn't matter, and that's after we've had three treaties passed which has transferred huge chunks of our sovereignty. So you've got a credibility gap, and can you believe anything our Prime Minister says now?
So how did you get on with him personally?
Well, in 2000 he was a very nice, I thought he was very charming, very nice sort of guy, sort of chap you can sit down, and I had quite a few pints with him in a pub. And very nice, but somehow, to my dismay, he seemed to be changed quite rapidly after he became the MP for...
But doesn't that happen with everybody when they get... The closer they get to power they get, they kind of... It's almost like a rock band or whatever, selling out. Don't people sell out when they get close to power?
Well, that's it. I think he was genuine at that time. If he wasn't genuine, he was just lying through his teeth to me, but I think he was genuine. And I think what happens is they're so power hungry, they so want to make their mark on history and be in the history books forevermore, that when they're approached by, well, let's say the corporate entities that really run this world, they can't resist the chance to change all their views.
Okay, now you've really intrigued me there. Corporate entities that really run this world, who are they?
Well, you don't see them walking down the street or anything, but you get hints of them from time to time. You get Nathan Rothschild, who's successor to the Rothschild dynasty, who takes people like Mandelson and George Osborne on cruising trips. I don't know whether Cameron's been any of these, but these are sort of glimpses you get of these people. And of course you've got the Bilderberg, where these people meet together to discuss what they're going to do with the world. And once you've jumped ship and come on board their launches, their cruise ships and all the rest of it, then you're stuck with it, aren't you? You can't go back. There's no going back.
Interesting, this week we've heard, you mentioned Bilderberg, I love talking about them. Well, nice that you're bringing it up for a change rather than me, is that the chief of AXA Insurance has quit after 16 years. He is the chairman of Bilderberg, and it looks like he's now going to be moving over to become the chairman or chief executive of HSBC, the bank which is well known now as the biggest money launderers on the planet, after their dealings with the Mexican drug cartels, and the way they survived the 2008 crisis was just to get into bed with the international drug dealers.
Well, I haven't been keeping up to date with the Bilderbergers, but I did write this book, which you know about, the EU a corporatist racket, and I have a chapter on the Bilderbergers in there. And this is not make-believe or conspiracy theories. I've been to the archives in University College London, where Gates School, when he died...
This is the former Labour leader.
Yeah, Labour leader, and who died. Some people say he might have been poisoned or something, because he died of lupus at a very inopportune time for the world. And he left about a dozen boxes of Bilderberg papers. He'd been sent all the documentation during the 12 years he was in the Bilderberg, and he lodged them in the University College London library.
Okay, yeah, but what I mean, in a nutshell, who are these people? What are they?
Well, they're you get invited to the Bilderberg. If you are considered to be a potential leader, when Attlee resigned, Gates School became the new leader of the Labour Party. He was in opposition at that time, but he would have been the Prime Minister, no doubt, instead of Wilson, if he hadn't have died inopportunely. So. He eventually decided he didn't like Bilderberg and stopped attending. He was always, I've got papers where he made these excuses. You've got to remember that Bilderberg was where the European Union, or the idea of the European Union, was first mooted. That's documented in my book. So Bilderberg is important. It's not a conspiracy theory. People didn't know about Bilderberg before 1976. It became prominent when Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands was caught out.
The former SS officer, German aristocrat.
Yes,
he was the chairman for the first 20 years.
Yes, yeah, FG Farben.
IG Farben, yeah.
Sorry, IG, yeah, Farben. And a Nazi, because he managed to whitewash all that and became joined the Royal Air Force during the Second World War. He had wanted to join intelligence services, but the Admiralty actually stopped that. I don't know if he knew that. So he was given a secondary role, and he was also involved with the Arnhem.
The Americans wouldn't have anything to do with him either. Well, we've done a whole programme on here, haven't we?
Yeah.
Which, if anyone wants to have a listen to, it's very easy to find online. You just use your favourite search engine, not necessarily Google, to put in the search term "a bridge not far," because we're rather sceptical about whether the tanks at Arnhem, led by Lord Carrington, could have actually made it to relieve the Arnhem Bridge and then bring the war to a speedy end. And Carrington sort of twiddled his thumbs instead, and despite having a US 82nd Airborne paratroopers pointing their Tommy guns at his head, saying, "Why don't you get down the road and rescue your mates down there?" But anyway, we're talking about the EU referendum tonight, Dave.
Yes, that was the plan.
You're concerned, aren't you, about the Electoral Commission's arrangements for the 23rd of June? This is just under 2 months' time, isn't it? So,
23rd of June, well, that's two and a half months. I've got plenty of time, but because of the research I've done, and there's a chapter in my book on the 1975 referendum, because of the research I've done there, and the way in which it was handled, I am quite concerned that it might be interfered with in some sort of way, as it certainly was in 1975.
You mean in a way other than just people throwing money at the campaigns? Because
there's always that. There's always a massive overspend by the...
Are there any actual limits on how much the Brexit and
I'd like to come to that in a second, because I'd just like to go through the 75 referendum. In my book, I explain what happened. In 1975, the referendum was directed by Mr. Roy Jenkins. That wasn't a very good idea, in my opinion.
Are you talking about a kind of returning officer or what?
No. He was the Home Secretary, but he was directing it. And he appointed Lord Allen of Abbeydale, who'd had no experience whatsoever in running a referendum before. And, of course, Roy Jenkins later on became the president of the... what was the equivalent of the EU, the EEC, soon afterwards. So you've got sort of conflict there of somebody who's...
Is it? Not beforehand. I mean, he was rewarded, I suppose, for doing a good job on getting the referendum.
Getting
the right result.
Yeah, you got the right... this is going to take a little while to just go through. Lord Abbeydale hadn't got a clue about running a referendum, and the arrangement at that time was all the ballot boxes from the various constituencies were not going to be counted at the constituency level. They're all going to be shipped to Earl's Court. I don't know if you've heard that. I've got the pictures of the count there. And they were shipped by special trains all over the country, and then special fleets of lorries and things to be counted in Earl's Court. Then 5 weeks before the actual referendum, they changed their mind and decided to have the count in 12 regional centres. So everything was topsy-turvy, and by his own admission, he said the whole situation was chaotic. Now, my theory is that you create a chaotic situation where nobody knows what's going on, and it presents an ideal opportunity for interference with these ballot
boxes. So what's happening this time?
And just to prove the point, and it's only something I've cottoned on to in the last couple of weeks, is the results. In 1971, only 20% of the population were in favour of joining the then common market.
Well, that's a poll, is it?
Poll of polls. So it's a pretty accurate figure. I've got all the polling data. 4 years later, in 1975, we see that 66% of the population voted to stay in the common market. And that was after all the traumas that we had in the early 70s, high unemployment caused by the EU, the European Community, and... high inflation went up to 26%. Now, if you take that figure, that's a swing, believe it or not, of 330%. 330% over 4 years. It's just not feasible. So I think that's the smoking gun.
Well, what about, what I'm trying to do is compare what's going to happen on the 23rd of June to what was happening back in the 1970s. So what's happening with the count this time?
The plan here this time seems a bit more open. The count will take place like ordinary general elections and council elections at the local level in the councils. And normally the results would be declared by the returning officer or the counting officer, the 650 or whatever it is polling station and polling areas, and then you would know it's very transparent. You can't feel it. You've got people standing around, but no, they're not doing this. These results have got to be the returning officer has got to send them to their local regional centre, the regional counting officer.
Well, why can't they declare the results locally?
They could, and that's what... this is the point we are complaining about.
Okay, we're saying, so you say we are complaining. What's happening? You've got a letter, I understand.
Yeah, we've formed a committee called the Independent Committee for Supervision of the 216 2016 referendum procedures and practices.
Ah, but you're, hang on, you're not really independent, are you? You're mostly UKippers, you're Brexit people.
No, I've left UKIP because I want to...
Okay, but are you all part of the...
No, we're all different. Some people are across... I think we're all wanting to leave the EU, but we call ourselves independent. If you think we're independent, we've still got a good argument here. It's a five-page letter.
Okay, can you summarise the letter that you've sent to the Electoral Commission for me, then?
Very difficult, because it's 5 pages long. But basically, we're asking them that the count be announced at the time of the count, straight afterwards, and not have the results sent to the returning office, because their procedure is that once the count is... The count will be secret until it's been sent upwards, communicated upwards to the regional officer and then the national county officer, and presumably the government. It's all going to be put upstairs, and if they don't like the result, there's a suspicion they might delay.
Have they given a reason for doing it that way?
No, we don't know the reason, and there is no reason. And the other thing. So that letter went in this week, and we're waiting for a reply. We've got 8 people on this committee, all very concerned, and this has become very, very public. And the other thing we're concerned about is that the main side, the people who want to stay in the EU, seem to be getting a bigger spending allowance than the people who want
to
come
out. Well, that's not fair. How much?
Oh, about... Just over two to one. But the way they've done it is because they're giving an allowance, a spending limit to the Leave side, which is equal to the Remain side, but they're giving the political parties another an amount equivalent to what the Remain side. So if you double those up, you've got 2-1 in their favour, because all the political parties except UKIP, which won't get any money at all because they've only got one MP, they're all going...
Government departments have been told that they are not allowed to cooperate with the Brexit campaigners?
I don't think... No, that's true, because quite a few Conservative MPs, Labour MPs, are actually part of the Leave.
Yeah, but they're not able to use their ministries to help them in their campaigning, are they?
Oh, I don't know too much about that. I'm not surprised that they're not manipulated. This is what happens all the time. There'll be huge manipulation. But I was not very happy about having a referendum, because I can't...
No, that's interesting, because you, as a Brexit campaigner, I would have thought that this is your golden opportunity.
Well, I'm very worried that we won't win it because of the way it'd be fiddled, although I'm a bit more optimistic than I was. But if we don't get a satisfactory answer from the Electoral Commission and the referendum board... and get them to agree to change their procedure and have the count announced locally straight away afterwards, then I think there's widespread opportunity for some sort of fiddling.
Now, you've said that we don't need a referendum. Why have you said that?
Well, this is a bit of ideology of mine, really. I've always thought we didn't get a referendum to go in 1971. In fact, there were a lot of people, Tony Benn and quite a few others were campaigning vigorously to get a referendum, but they were jeered at and mocked and told they were being anti-parliamentary, which meant that they thought he shouldn't be doing this, and it should be Parliament decides who whether we're going in or not. So we didn't get the opportunity for referendum to go in, and we haven't had any referendums on any of the treaties, the Rome Treaty, the Maastricht Treaty, the Treaty of Amsterdam, which followed. We've had about 6 treaties, all of which are constitutional, contrary to the constitutional, without any referendum. If you don't get a referendum then, why do we need one now?
So who really runs the EU?
Well, that's pretty obvious, isn't it? My book tells the title.
Just remind us of your title of your book, Colm.
The book is called "The EU: A Corporatist Racket." Now, I've proven, I think, beyond any doubt, that the EU was started by the corporate entities, particularly American corporate interests. In fact, it's more of an American setup than a European setup, the EU. And
which corporations particularly?
I've got a list of the corporations which...
Well, just off the top of your head, what's one?
Well, IBM for a start. IBM, Esso, well, the Standard
Exxon,
Oil.
Exxon, yeah.
Big, massive companies. They're all financing the European movement back in the 1948 and onwards. So basically, the EU, the European movement is owned by these corporate entities, and they campaign pretending to be a grassroots organisation.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it, that they're a kind of... corporations making up most of the laws and rules and policies in the EU that just then get rubber stamped by the MPs, and the MPs don't have really have any process in actually drawing up the laws.
That's right. My subtitle to this book is How the European Union Was Created by Global Corporatism for Global Corporatism.
Well, thanks very much, Dave, for coming all the way from Whitney to explain all that to us. And let us know if you get a reply from the Electoral Commission.
Yeah, we will. Not already had too much hope, but we're going to chase them. We're going to chase them up.
Okay, thanks very much for joining us.
BCFM.
Now, Martin, before we close, Trump says he wouldn't take the use of nuclear weapons in Europe off the table. He's actually... I can't quite understand why he's not talking about using nuclear weapons in other parts of the world, but he's quite happy to use nuclear weapons in Europe, Donald Trump.
Well, that's rather strange, because in many respects, Trump, despite his bombastic nature, has actually talked more sense about relations with Russia than the mainstream candidates like Hillary Clinton. There is a danger, as the Russian foreign ministry has said, we're probably closer to a nuclear war now than we've ever been because of the attitude of the West towards us. And Trump, in fact, has actually been shocking the establishment in the US by saying, well, why can't we just get along with Vladimir Putin? Why do we need to pick a fight with him?
Also, horrific, really, news for the family of Jean-Charles de Menezes this week. The European Court has rubber-stamped the police murder of Jean-Charles de Menezes. The death of Jean-Charles was a result of Britain's shoot-to-kill policy adopted in secret 2 years earlier in high-level discussion between top police officers and the Labour government of Tony Blair. Part of Operation Kratos, a repressive legislation adopted on the basis of the war against terror, it gave Scotland Yard authority to deploy armed squads and, if necessary, to deliver a critical headshot to suspected bombers. The policy was first employed against an innocent man with no evidence whatsoever of imposing a threat.
Well, I mean, it's a cover-up, isn't it? I mean, the claim that the CCTV cameras in Stockwell Station were all not working that day and therefore there was no CCTV footage of the shooting. And from what
sounds a bit like 7/7, doesn't it? No CCTV of that.
Everybody thinks they've seen pictures of the bombers on 7/7 going through the seas, going through the underground. But in actual fact, that's the dry run the week before. And coming back to our earlier discussion, you can create terrorist cells if you are an intelligence agency, and then you can eliminate them as you wish. And of course, we had the Swedish chap who was convicted of supposedly going to Syria to join a jihadi group. He was on trial in the Old Bailey, and of course it turned out that he was working with the group he was going to join was an MI6 fronted group.
In July 2006, the Crown Prosecution Service ruled that no officer could realistically be prosecuted because it could not be proved beyond reasonable doubt that police believed Jean-Charles was not a suicide bomber. Now that's extraordinary, isn't it? How are you going to prove anybody is not a suicide bomber? Absurd. That means that the police could go in and shoot anybody in the head.
Well, what it seems happens from what eyewitnesses saying is that they jumped out, he walked down there, they said he jumped over the barriers, and then they killed him with one shot. But in actual fact, they chased him down and shot him down and shot him in, you know, with no warnings given or what have you. One of the things.
It's time to sign off now for the Murdoch News at 7. Up next, Arabian Nights with Mohammed Makawi. Sorry to cut you short there, Martin. We're online at thisweek.org.uk, and I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for the politics show at 5 next week with all the mayor candidates, and don't let the banksters get you down.